dodges. I ride in this wind on my good horse. I call you my shiny black bears to the playhouse of fortune to take the bright silver and gold you have taken from somebody else. And this we go.
You're listening to episode 524 of Unwelcome Guests, Dispatches from the Chemical Civil War. I'm Robin Upton. This week we're looking at dangerous chemicals. Our second hour is a long interview with Emmanuel Schick Garcia about double dipping from the world's leading chemical companies, not only producing carcinogenic chemicals, but spotting the opportunity to make money from treating cancer. So if you've ever wondered why so much emphasis is put on treating cancer and not on preventing cancer, then this will give you some insight into that. In our first hour, we've got two items, second of which is an interview about the world's largest chemical industrial disaster. It's been called the Hiroshima of the chemical industry. That is the pesticide factory explosion in Bhopal in 1984. But first we're going to hear from Adam Curtis with a radio adaptation of episode from his series Pandora's Box. This is part 4, Goodbye Mrs. Ant, about the rise and fall of pesticides as a chemical cure-all.
Prologue. When chemists were heroes.
Thomas Midgley was born in 1889. He became a chemist and an inventor. In 1921, he solved the problem of knocking in car engines. He put lead in petrol. In 1930, he discovered a new coolant for fridges. It was called by its initials, CFC.
There's a cover from a 1950 film by the E.L. DuPont Company.
Midgley became part of a golden age of chemistry in America in the 30s.
Big cheery capital letters, a new world through chemistry.
Chemistry, alchemy, magic. The modern laboratory of today's chemist, fantastic in appearance as it is far out in the very vanguard of progress. The holy of holies, wherein science moves in mysterious ways her wonders to perform.
In 1935, Midgley predicted that in the future, chemistry would solve many of the world's great problems. The ozone layer, he said, could be altered to control the sun's rays and allow scientists to govern the world's agriculture. In 1940, Midgley contracted polio. He built a pulley system to lift himself in and out of bed. But in 1944, he became trapped in it and strangled himself. That same year, the American Army began mass-producing CFC to help spray a new, some said miracle, chemical over the Pacific battlefields. It killed insects. It was called DDT.
Goodbye, Mrs. Ant. Professor Robert Metcalf, entomologist, National Defense Research Committee, 1943-46.
I was a project officer on the first aerial application of DDT that was ever made in the world, I guess. And we flew it over several square miles of jungle, and I was walking around some trails we'd cut in the jungle floor, and there was an incredible, describable rain of insects of all kinds coming down out of the tops of these huge jungle trees, 100 to 130, 40, 50 feet. We got the cerambycid beetles, beetles of all descriptions, and probably many people had never seen, or if anybody had ever seen, because they're in the tops of the trees. I remember particularly some big of these longhorn beetles that were coming down. There were wasps and bees of all descriptions and so forth, and it was an incredible experience. And I guess what occurred to me then is that maybe this was one of the best ways to collect insects and find out what kind of insects there truly were in a representative area of the jungle. And that's just one of the more innocent things I guess one could read into it.
The low-flying planes cover every section of the city, from the coast of Manila Bay to the outlying environs, in an effort to destroy the large numbers of flies and mosquitoes plaguing the area. Prior to the spraying, the populace was informed that the insecticide would not injure vegetation or clothes.
In American bars, there was a drink which was called Mickey Slim. And it was a good gin with a spot of DDT in it. And this was supposed to give you a feeling of happiness and merriment.
Then in Naples, in 1943 and 44, there was an enormous epidemic of typhus transmitted by the human body louse, and about 10 million applications of DDT dusting powder were made to people, and they wiped that out. And those things got enormous publicity in household magazines like the Reader's Digest. Everybody wanted to try DDT, and the civilian population could hardly wait to get their hands on it when it was released in 1945 for civilian use.
Harry Rankin, Illinois farmer.
Well, it was sort of a miracle that happened, and by word of mouth, it spread rapidly, and I think everyone tried it. I remember one time in 1952, it was summertime, and we were going to have a birthday party right here on the lawn, right here where we're sitting. And the day before, I sprayed all the grass with water and DDT, and this got rid of the flies, and it also killed mosquitoes. And you know, flies in the afternoon while the sun's shining and mosquitoes after dark, those are two things. If you could get away from them, you could have a wonderful party out here. And we did. We had a pest-free party out here on this farm.
Chemical people would show us test plots, and the quality of the corn would have little small ears where the weeds and the insects had taken over, and where they'd used the chemicals, the ears were bigger, and with the yield was 2 to 3 times as much.
The United States was a continent plagued with insects. Farmers lived in perpetual fear of finding a new infestation. Whole crops were regularly destroyed by pests. DDT and the other insecticides invented in its wake promised victory in this war.
This man is a farmer, yes. But he is also a detective, a plant pest detective.
A giant spider. What next?
Shirley Briggs, biologist in the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, 1945-48.
You don't in England. Anything like the insect life that we have. You don't have to have screens on the windows in many places. Can't survive here that way.
Come on, just a little bit.
We are edgier about them.
1958, Earth versus the Spider.
Anything with 6 legs is...
Yes, this is our enemy. Insects not only eat up our agriculture, they threaten the very health of our land.
A 1950s spider tramples cars and menaces young couples in a gratuitous but terrifying fashion. Lillard Hedden, crop sprayer, 1945 to 1983.
In the time, full fields of crops would be ruined from the insects before the chemicals come into effect. I can remember cutworms and wireworms would absolutely clean the fields of corn and wheat, and there would be nothing left to harvest. And then when your chemicals come along, you had this to eliminate the insects, and you had your crop then.
It was a miracle chemical to us because we thought it would control practically every insect. I guess it was just a time in the period that God had decided that he would let us discover these chemicals and use them wisely. And I suppose everything, the whole system is directed by God. So I guess this was the time that we would find our knowledge given by God would lead us to find these natural resources to use to control, do away with some of the slave labor.
The incredible success of insecticides led to a wave of invention. Chemists vied with each other to design new, more powerful products. This in turn transformed other sciences, in particular the study of insects, entomology. Entomologists had traditionally been figures of fun, eccentric scientists who spent their time classifying insects. But this was now important information for the chemical companies. They began to employ large numbers of entomologists. In the process, the focus of their science began to shift.
Professor Robert Metcalf, entomologist, National Defense Research Committee, 1943-46.
We were fed these new chemicals so rapidly, many of us didn't have time to do anything else but test the new chemicals. There seemed to be the chemicals being introduced into the pipeline and inexhaustible pressure to put something out the other end. And we forgot about good basic entomology and became, in a sense, I think, handmaidens of the world chemical industry.
The entomologists began to discover what appeared to be serious side effects. As they investigated the effectiveness of large-scale spraying programs, they found that many other species of wildlife were being harmed.
Dr. Eugene Kaniga, research entomologist, Dow Chemical Company, 1940-82.
We found out soon that there were some side effects, even as early as 1946 and 47. But the benefits were so great, we eradicated malaria from the United States, let alone many other places in the world. And so there wasn't the public pressure on. We were killing off birds in some cases. It was quite obvious that these species were disappearing starting in 47 or 48. And by 53, even the birds that lived quite a few years were beginning to disappear, and they weren't replacing themselves because the eggs weren't hatching.
These side effects led to serious disagreements among the entomologists. At their annual conference in 1953, their president made an impassioned defense of the chemicals. His speech was entitled, "The Greater Hazard, Insects or Insecticides." The choice, he said, was a simple one. Either continue spraying or return to the bad old days of starvation and disease. Everything should be done to minimize the side effects, but ultimately it was a war of survival. Insecticides had already saved 100 million human lives throughout the world.
At our scientific congresses and meetings, we were completely immersed in a haze of propaganda about chemicals. There were lavish hospitality suites, banquets sponsored by the chemical companies, and a great many entomologists were employed by these companies, and I'm sure they were absolutely convinced that what they were doing was a fundamental and a very valuable importance to the world.
Goodbye, Mrs. Ant. By the University of Georgia Agricultural Extension Service in cooperation with the Velsicol Chemical Corporation.
The chemical companies also portrayed the battle against the insects as a necessary war. Promotional films of the 1950s invoked Charles Darwin. They depicted it as part of the inevitable struggle for existence.
Wherever man is, there the ant is also. They seem to come from nowhere and suddenly are everywhere at once, crawling over the food. As the hordes invade, man often gives up his pleasures in utter despair. It is the law of nature. The strong survive.
Footage of a vexed-looking 1950s family giving up the struggle to survive on a family picnic and going home after discovering ants on the food. Dr. Thomas Jukes, research chemist, American Cyanamid Company, 1945-63.
Now, in evolution, all living species are essentially in competition with each other, and the ones that are most successful survive. And insects, as has been said, will inherit the earth because they're so successful. And insects carry diseases to human beings, such as malaria, and when we spray to kill the insects, we're interfering with evolution. If evolution were to proceed, then we would be overwhelmed by the factors that are against us.
Do you realize how easy it would be for them to overcome us humans? Then instead of being the hunters, we'd become the hunted. They'd be our masters. They'd live on us.
James Moore, biographer of Charles Darwin.
When people in the post-war period spoke of a struggle in nature, they were selecting one aspect of Darwin's theories that suited their time. Now, for Darwin, nature was a bloody battlefield. There were winners and losers, victors and the vanquished. But this imagery took on special significance in the Cold War years. In the American Midwest, when I was growing up, the household aerosols were called insect bombs. The point is that in these life and death struggles, scientists believed that they were seizing power from evolution and redirecting it by controlling the environment. They took it on faith from the biologists that this is how the world works. And then they chose to emphasize those aspects of Darwin's theory which fitted in best with the industrial programs they were embarked upon. This was not a neutral reading of Darwin at all. This was an interested reading.
Anything left behind?
Nothing but a dead spider.
Well, this time he's going to stay dead. Dead and buried.
Well, let's say at least until some egghead comes along and digs it up again. Yeah.
The first serious public attack on the widespread use of pesticides came from Rachel Carson. She was a biologist who had worked for the United States Fish and Wildlife Service. In the late 50s, she began collecting evidence of the side effects. In particular, studies which showed that DDT was becoming more concentrated as it worked its way into the bodies of larger animals. In 1962, she wrote a book called Silent Spring. It was an attack on the chemical companies.
Shirley Briggs, friend of Rachel Carson, biologist in the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, 1945-48.
It started coming out in the New Yorker. She kept it rather quiet. She knew that the chemical industry, or the part of it she was worrying about, would react. And sure enough, the official of the Velsicol Chemical Company wrote a very threatening letter to Houghton Mifflin. "You must not print this book." And came out with the standard line that they still use. "You see, if we stop using all these pesticides, it would simply ruin the whole economy of the country. And this is a sinister plot by the far-left subversive forces, as they called them, to destroy the United States."
Silent Spring painted a dramatic picture of a poisoned America. It caused an immediate sensation. It coincided with revelations about thalidomide and the fallout of strontium 90 from nuclear testing.
Gordon Edwards, entomologist.
When I got the book, when I got home, I read that, and I got about two-thirds of the way through the book, and I saw so many things I knew were not true that it bothered me. When I set out to make a lot of speeches to try to let people know what she had said and what was really the truth, many other people were doing the same thing across the nation. So usually, at some time during the talk, somebody would be interested in what about the effect on people. And it was handy at that time to have a box of DDT like this one, and so I could just dump some out in my hand and take some of it to show that it's not harmful to people. Never has been. Nobody's ever been killed by DDT. I've not even heard of anybody being made ill by it, even when they attempt suicide.
In 1963, the book was made the subject of an hour-long TV special. Three of the program's sponsors, food and chemical manufacturers, withdrew in protest. Carson used the program to widen her attack on the chemical companies.
Now, to these people, apparently the balance of nature was something that was repealed as soon as man came on the scene. Well, you might just as well assume that you could repeal the law of gravity. Man's attitude toward nature is today critically important, simply because we have now acquired a fateful power to alter and to destroy nature. Unless we do bring these chemicals under better control, we are certainly headed for disaster.
Dr. Robert White Stevens, chemical industry spokesman.
Ms. Carson maintains that the balance of nature is a major force in the survival of man, whereas the modern chemist, the modern biologist, the modern scientist believes that man is steadily controlling nature. If man were to faithfully follow the teachings of Miss Carson, we would return to the Dark Ages, and the insects and diseases and vermin would once again inherit the earth.
The ironic thing was how Robert White Stevens died. He died as the result of the sting of a wasp.
In 1963, Rachel Carson died. Although her book had caused an outcry, it had no immediate effect on the use of pesticides. But another attack on the chemical industry was about to be launched, this time from the suburbs.
Although the faces of America's major cities seem relatively unchanged, a quiet revolution has been taking place there for nearly a decade. More than 1 million persons each year have pulled up stakes in the cities and turned commuter.
America's suburbs had grown enormously during the 50s, often on land made habitable for the first time with the elm, now brought the side effects of the chemicals into the gardens of the wealthy and articulate middle classes.
Laurie Otto, resident of a Milwaukee suburb.
We live in what's called the Gold Coast area, the wealthier people, and so we had money right away to buy this stuff and the machinery and the men, and so they went around and squirted, first of all, from the ground. But that didn't last very long. Soon, there was a whole page in the Sunday Milwaukee Journal on how now Shorewood and Fox Point and Bayside, where I live, were really going to take care of their elm trees. And they had a photograph of a helicopter spraying with DDT. And not too long after that, the robin started going to the vultures. It would start out, you'd see the robin, you'd think it would be all right, and then all of a sudden the swimming would go on.
Those robins got in the way of the spray and they got drenched with DDT and they fell to the ground. There they were, twitching and paralyzed. And that seemed like a terrible thing, and it was for those robins. But there were millions of other robins that weren't being hurt at all.
You'd be awakened by this of them coming over the house. And one day I was so angry that I raced up into the attic and opened the dormer windows in my little pink nightie, and I climbed up on top of the roof and I just stood there and shook my fist at them.
What happened next was that there was a spraying of DDT in Long Island, and Mrs. Yannicone didn't like it.
Carol Yannicone.
The first time I noticed it, I drove past here on my way home from work, and there were dead fish for about 10 feet out from the side. This is noticeable as you drive by.
Victor Yannicone.
The massive fish kill in this lake, and as we later found out, other lakes, were all ignored, largely because the suburban population that was seeing this had nothing to compare it against, having come from the concrete canyons of Manhattan and Brooklyn and Queens, where I came from, and not knowing what the natural state was supposed to be. The scientific community, which should have been observing all of this, was too busy making new products or living in their ivory towers. Let us take charge. We will bring you better things for better living through chemistry.
Victor Yannicone was a lawyer. Together with two local biologists, he founded the Environmental Defense Fund. Its aim was to legally challenge the use of DDT and other pesticides. Their argument was that the chemicals were spreading in uncontrollable ways, becoming more poisonous as they did so. One of the strongest pieces of evidence was the disappearance of the peregrine falcon. DDT was being found in their bodies, and their eggs were failing to hatch. Two ornithologists set out to count the falcon population.
Daniel Berger, ornithologist, University of Wisconsin, 1965 to 68.
We were simply going to follow a route from northern Alabama all the way up to the state of Maine. And we started in, I believe it was early April. And birds should be on location at that time. And we simply worked our way northward, and we followed a very torturous route, and we checked something like 130 sites or something like that in the course of the next 3 months, driving a little over 14,000 miles. We found zero, not one peregrine falcon.
In 1968, the Environmental Defense Fund discovered an obscure law in the Midwestern state of Wisconsin. It allowed anyone a legal hearing if they believed they could prove water pollution in the state. Using this as a pretext, the fund engineered a hearing, and in November 1968, a small group of them traveled to Madison, the capital of Wisconsin, in the heartland of America's agriculture. The hearing was held in the vast state legislature. It quickly became a trial of DDT. The star was Victor Yannicone. His main aim was to get the public's attention, to explain why tiny amounts of a chemical could have such large effects.
We had to explain that a part per million was significant. We did this by calling a very prominent scientist from the pro-DDT camp And we asked him a very simple series of questions. Doctor, do you have any idea what the purpose of the hormones that flow in your blood is? Yeah. And they're responsible for your secondary sex characteristics, the hair on your head, the hair on your chest, the tone of your voice, right? Do you have any idea what the level of testosterone in your bloodstream is necessary to give you that lovely shock of white hair, all that hair on the chest and the grandchildren that you're so proud of? And he finally admitted that it was 5 parts per million. I said, well, do you have any idea what would happen if the level of testosterone in your blood should drop to as low as 3.5 parts per million? He averred he didn't know, and I said, well, you know that hair of yours would change, the hair on your chest would disappear, the hair on the rest of your body would change, your voice would go up to a little squeak, and you sure as hell wouldn't have any grandchildren. The public got the point. 1 part per million could be very significant.
The Madison hearing soon became headline news, with both sides claiming that everything America stood for was at stake.
Dr. Hugh Iltis, ecologist, University of Wisconsin, 1968.
I walked in, Yanacone looked at me long and hard and says, I think he'll do. And then he looked at me and says, can you between now and tomorrow put together a lecture of about 40 slides of all the different pictures of the Wisconsin ecosystem so it'll be not only beautiful but emotionally rich and will affect the people who listen to it? So I said, I'll try. Next day I came here and gave this talk with beautiful slides of the prairies and the woods of Wisconsin. It was, I'm sure, the first time anybody has ever shown wildflowers in the chambers of the Wisconsin legislature.
In the late 60s, ecology was a modest scientific backwater. Ecologists spent their time studying the mutual dependence and balance of all the inhabitants of a particular area. But for Yanacone, ecology was a powerful weapon with which to attack the defenders of DDT, especially the entomologists. It gave him a scientific basis to challenge the idea of evolution they used to justify the large spraying programs.
The entomologists, who should have known better and now 30 years later admit they should have known better, simply saw the death and the extinction of what we now know to be beneficial insects as the operation of the fundamental law of survival and evolution. What they didn't realize is the kind of evolution they were looking toward was the evolution of monsters arising from garbage dumps, of chemically deformed animals and plants. What they thought would come out of this was a simplified world ecosystem with good plants, bad plants, weeds, good insects, bad insects, good animals, the ones we eat, bad animals, the ones that take up space.
There was a problem, though. If human beings were inextricably interwoven with other parts of nature, as ecology said, where were the effects of DDT on humans? In 30 years, no worker in the DDT factories had been poisoned. The defenders made great play of this at the hearing. But then in early 1969, the Environmental Defense Fund received some unexpected news.
A Swedish chemist by the name of Göran Löfroth wrote a letter saying that they have found in almost all women in Sweden DDT in the mother's milk. Well, we went to my house, we finally said, hey, let's call up Sweden. And we did. We got him out of bed. He must have been 4 o'clock in the morning then. He spoke pretty good English. What do you want? He said, we want you in medicine. He said he would come. Thursday came and went. Friday at 10 o'clock, people went out to the airport. It was all hush-hush because the testimony was droning on and on and on, the pesticide this and the chickens that and the eggs this and so forth and so on. My God, when just hours, I mean, we have, after all, we have 14 of these volumes, 2,800 pages of testimony. The stenographers went bananas. Anyway, at 11:30, somebody high-hoed me, little sign, and we went outside the hall, and sure enough, there was Göran Löfroth with his little suitcase. In the meanwhile, of course, we had called the New York Times, the Chicago Tribune, the Washington Washington Post, all these reporters were waiting in the wings. And then for the next 3 hours, Göran Löfroth laid it on the line that if babies eat, drink milk of cows that grazed on land that was sprayed with DDT, their fat is going to contain DDT. And not only this, but its fat, of course, is in the brain. Most brain is fat. It will be loaded with DDT by Sunday, front page of the Sunday New York Times. And the opposition was just livid with rage, but we won that one.
When I heard it was banned, I really felt bad about it because I felt it was a victory against science. And I felt that scientists and industry had a place in this country. And certainly being undermined by the statements about pesticides in general, it's gotten worse since then, of course. After banning DDT, the others were easy. Somebody said maybe because DDT was so easy to spell that people immediately thought about it.
Where once chemicals were seen as good, now they were bad. In the early 1970s, press and television became fascinated by any reports of the side effects of pesticides and herbicides.
News report from Arizona, 1972.
What happened? That leg's just malformed, but when he was crippled, he was born after the strain this year. That's the only evidence involved.
And above all, by the effects on human beings.
The first analysis was phoned to me yesterday to say they have found the residues of 2,4-D. So I guess I'm the first documented case to say it is residual in the human body after you've been exposed to it.
The battle against DDT had been won ultimately by evidence of its presence in humans. Now the Environmental Defense Fund placed advertisements in the national papers implying that DDT caused cancer. Donations flooded in, but the decision split the leadership.
The Environmental Defense Fund and Carol and I parted company over the issue of whether the shift should be from the questions that we were sure of, that DDT was bad for the environment, to the speculation that DDT might cause cancer. I don't believe in going to court on speculation. I go to court on relatively solid evidence. DDT is not good for mammalian systems. It damages the nervous system, it damages the liver enzyme systems, it causes some problems. It is not a strong carcinogen. It is not, except in very large doses, associated with serious human health hazard. Its real problem is that it had the capacity, had it continued to be used at the rate it was being used, to literally destroy almost the entire world natural ecological system on which we really depend, and would have meant the ultimate collapse of the human species as an animal species.
The DDT hearing was a watershed, not just for the battle against chemical pollution, but for the science of ecology. Ecologists became influential figures, giving scientific advice in the battles against other pesticides. But in the process, their science was transformed. It became the guiding force of the environmental movement.
Langdon Winner, historian of science.
Beginning with the unintended consequences of DDT, the science of ecology had emerged as a useful tool in science, and many people began to see it as something that could be drawn upon for moral enlightenment as well, the notion of everything being connected to everything else.
It's the relationship between me and plants and animals and the world in general.
I remember the first time I ever heard the word environmentalist on the air was on an Oscar Godfrey show, and he was trying to explain what it was, and it was hard for him to explain what the era was. So it was really a new era.
2 days ago, a man whose controversial predictions of a forthcoming global catastrophe have made him an international figure arrived at London's Heathrow Airport. He is Paul Ehrlich, professor of biology at Stanford University, California, and the chief spokesman for the so-called ecological movement.
Dr. Ehrlich, just how realistic is your projected theory of the eco-catastrophe?
Well, I think that it's getting more realistic all the time. The signs are getting worse, but I still have considerable hope because although governments are very slow, people all over the world are awakening very rapidly to what the real danger is.
In much the same way as the science of entomology had been changed in the 1950s, now ecology was transformed by the social and political pressures of the early 70s. ecologists became the moral and spiritual guardians of a new view of the human relationship to nature. And they too cited Darwin's laws to prove that their view was correct.
James Moore, biographer of Charles Darwin.
Nature has a set of laws that all organisms have to obey by necessity, because that's the way they evolved, and this applies to human beings very much so. If we need to introduce into our lives nature, it is a need that is enormously deep. Look around you wherever you go into homes. There are not only living flowers, they're not only aquaria and pets. Look at the wall. What do we see? Sunflowers by Van Gogh, or irises by Van Gogh, or pictures, photographs of landscapes. You don't see framed in a house a picture of a crankshaft from a Ford, or a tin can squashed. Now, in modern art, which is a sick art, because it reflects the confusion in the human minds. Yes, indeed.
Darwin's so big that he can support any number of generalizations about the world. I mean, given Darwin's image as a scientific saint, people inevitably try to get him on the side of their view of nature. Now, Darwin was complex. In The Origin of Species, for example, the metaphors tumble over one another in the most unscientific way. Sure, nature's seen as being at war, but nature's also likened to a web of complex relations. Here, then, was another aspect of Darwin for people to seize on for their own purposes. Darwin gave them a basis for urging us not to take control of nature, but to cooperate with it, to stay within its balance. Again, Darwin serves up slogans. In the popular imagination, scientific theories are something fixed, and if they're good theories and accepted by creditable people, then they're absolute, and that's that. What people don't understand is that scientific theories never have a single meaning. They become a cultural property. They are usable, serviceable, for different interested parties.
After the DDT wars, we knew that science was not necessarily going to be the answer. But mankind in the 20th century still wanted to avoid responsibility for their own individual actions. Now it's nature that's going to permit us to shift the responsibility from human beings to some force that we don't have to take responsibility for.
Joan Fairfax, the Ojai Foundation, California.
What we're talking about is a very profound internal shift of attitude and of values. This is the gift of ecology to human beings, and really to all species today. And that gift can give rise to not utopia, but ecotopia, which is this profound sense of place, the sense of coming home at last. I think it is a moral lesson. There is a possibility for a kind of utopia. We've dreamed about it. And that possibility exists in our future.
Langdon Winner, historian of science.
The scientific and technological notions of the 1950s, the ideas of endless possibilities for exploitation of nature, are now seen as ill-conceived and ill-guided. I'm haunted by the possibility that the ideas of ecology that we now embrace today may in 30 or 40 years seem similarly ill-conceived. And they're no more scientific than, let's say, other notions of nature that we have looked to in the past.
At least when science was our god, we felt that we were actively doing something. We were in control. Now there are too many people that say, there's nothing I can do. Nature will take care of it. I just will continue fat, dumb, and happy the way I am. We must go back to the simple lesson of history. Every human being concerned enough, dedicated enough, and willing to make the sacrifice can change the world around them.
In 1860, Charles Darwin wrote to a friend in America about whether it is possible to seek divine providence in nature. I feel most deeply, he said, that the whole subject is too profound for the human intellect. A dog might as well speculate on the mind of Newton. Let each man hope and believe what he can.
I'm tempted to call it extraordinary that J. Random lawyer Viktor Yanuko was there with the right headspace, and he could see what was going on, and he knew how to communicate to people. One part per million is a very significant amount, and they found that law. I would call it extraordinary, except that I think this is actually how real change occurs, through people motivated not by an institutional agenda. That, I think, is the myth that we are often sold, that it's up to them to organize things because they have the power and the money and the training and the experts, whereas in fact it always comes down to people. Now, is there an enlightened on high, a special group of people who have the power and the brains to make this change? Or does it come down to individuals acting from their heart? Recalling last week's show from Illich, I think that he was really onto something about the disabling effect of institutions. And although it's confusing to us who have been brought up in a world addicted to large institutions, in which if you talk about them, they did this, they did that, it needs no further clarification than just a group of people whose power, and we don't often even reflect on them as people. But thank you to Adam Curtis for shedding light on this, because I had understood DDT, toxic chemical, it got banned. I hadn't noticed just how much it came down to individuals, also to Rachel Carson and the people who were motivated by passion, opposing a large bureaucracy, a large moneyed machine. And I can see the same thing playing out in genetic engineering. There's a good friend of mine with a PhD in biology and chemistry, you know who you are, whose first reaction when queried on genetic engineering, is it safe, he was in the business of science education, is to go to who is the established wisdom, to look it up in the Academic Citations Index, which inside of that headspace makes perfect sense. There is an answer. They offer a solution. This is how we find out what is safe. This is how we find out what is credible evidence. And yet, it misses the larger picture. It misses the fact that not everybody doing those studies is an impartial arbiter, that people have had their own sense of judgment, their own sense of propriety. The experiments may very well be set up by institutions with agendas to push. Funding for journals may be cut if they criticize this. We know the deal. So inside of that headspace, the world appears to have some consistency. There appears to be a way to get things done. Only by looking outside that, beyond that, do people like Viktor Yanuko, the Swedish professor, other people who are looking at what is going on with a broader context in a social situation, can see how, if genetically engineered foods are, quote, substantially equivalent, that was a doctrine that was pushed through in order to obviate the need. There's no need for testing for safety for this stuff as food because it's so similar to natural food. Well, you could look at that on its own, and if you didn't know about science, you might think, well, fair enough, if that's what the experts say. But bear in mind also that this substantially equivalent is so different from natural food, from nature's produce, over which nobody has yet claimed ownership, that companies can say, well, this is ours. And if you're a farmer and our seeds blow onto your land, you should be paying us. And we don't care whether you want those seeds or not. If you're raising our property, which is those seeds, on your farm, you pay. So thank you to Percy Schmeisner for having the personal integrity to stand up to that kind of bullying outside of the economic frame. Because inside the economic frame, people have decided, well, it doesn't make sense to try and fight Monsanto. We just pay them some money and they'll be done with it. But that is the frame that would have poisoned us all with DDT. Now, is it carcinogenic? I don't know. But how long would it have gone on? How much more of nature would it have had to kill before institutions actually realized we are killing ourselves here, we are at war with nature, and we are part of nature at the same time? Would it have been an institution that did that? What does it even mean to say that an institution could do that? Doesn't it always come down to people? People choosing between an institutional agenda of what they have been told, because nobody was told this DDT stuff is going to be bad news, because officially it was safe. Not to get onto a big rant here, but I hope you understand this is more a message to my friend, actually, that we need to get beyond the frameworks that we have been given. At the very least, we need to question them, we need to recognize them, that we are a part of the system, and is that something that we want to be a part of? And that, of course, is a question that is never asked to anybody at school and is discouraged from then on in. But to return to the subject of toxic chemicals now, let's hear some more background about Bhopal. I mean, I was teaching in a school and I found a textbook in which it said hundreds of people were killed in Bhopal, terrible accident. That again is playing pretty fast and loose with the truth, because as we'll hear, thousands of people died on the day. Tens of thousands of people have since died or been incapacitated by this disaster. So is that textbook telling kids lies? Well, technically no, but in another sense very much so. It's certainly misleading them. Now, this is from 2009, 25 years after the disaster.
My name is Gary Cohn. I'm the director of Healthcare Without Harm.
My name is Akane Freechild. I'm the U.S. Strategy Coordinator for the International Campaign for Justice in Bhopal.
Could you contextualize the Bhopal Union Carbide disaster, which people may know occurred in December of 1984, but the background of the plant, what did it do, and the events leading up to December 1984?
Union Carbide built a pesticide factory in Bhopal, India, in the late 60s to expand into the Indian market for industrial scale agriculture. Within a few years, the plant was not making very much money. The market for their products hadn't expanded. And so the company, which is a subsidiary of the U.S. company, Union Carbide, decided to cut back on a number of safety systems, training for personnel, and other kinds of safety features. Workers in the plant saw that this was happening and started to alert the local media that there was a real disaster waiting to happen. And the company also had done some kind of safety report to suggest that there might be problems. And the safety report identified more than 50 problems in the factory. None of these were acted on. And as a result of this lack of responsibility, on the night of December 2nd and 3rd, 1984, there was a massive explosion and a gas leak out of the Union Carbide factory in Bhopal, spreading toxic chemicals across a city of 1 million people. And in one night, more than 8,000 people had died in the ensuing years from long health impacts related to their long-term exposure. More than 20,000 people have died. So Union Carbide really is the Hiroshima of the chemical industry.
I think that pretty much summarizes the background. I can talk a little bit about what happened that night. So imagine waking up around midnight with your eyes burning, not able to stop coughing, stumbling out of your bed, semi-blind, hearing people screaming and running in the streets, not sure what to do. Many people had their children with them and couldn't run. Others began to run when they heard that it wasn't just burning chilies or some other bizarre phenomenon, but actually a gas leak from this plant. And as they ran, they breathed in more and more of this toxic methyl isocyanate gas that Union Carbide had been storing at room temperature, highly reactive, for months, unrefrigerated. And as they breathed the gas in, they fell by the roadside and died. Many of them were suspended in animation and appeared to be dead. And there were many cases of people actually leaping off of funeral pyres because the cyanide that had gotten into their bloodstreams made them appear to be dead. As Gary described, the death toll was horrific the next day. The streets were littered with bodies, and the city was basically shut down and evacuated for several months after the disaster. But throughout this entire process, the police were not notified. There was no widespread alarm for the city when doctors desperately called the plant personnel asking what to do about these thousands of dying people that were pouring into the hospital. The experts, quote-unquote experts at Union Carbide, said there was no long-term effect and they should just wash their eyes with milk and water and eggs and they should be fine. And these are doctors who have dead people, dying people on their hands. So the company was completely unprepared and unaccountable. And in the days following the disaster, Warren Anderson, who was the CEO of Union Carbide at that time, decided to go to Bhopal and try to soothe the people of Bhopal. And he was immediately arrested upon arrival and charged with culpable homicide, among a number of other charges, along with Union Carbide as a company. And he posted a very small amount of bail, I believe it was $2,000. And has never returned. So those criminal charges have been outstanding since 1984. There's been no criminal justice whatsoever for the people of Bhopal.
Why was the plant placed near or among a fairly dense population?
Bhopal is very centrally located in India, has very strong rail lines that connect to both Bombay and Delhi and other parts around the country. So it was seen as an opportune place in which to site a pesticide factory. We find all over the world there are many very dangerous factories that have the same kind of potential of disastrous accident located in cities all around the world. In the United States, there's over 110 chemical facilities that are in areas where the population is a million or more people that could still cause a Bhopal-like disaster. And after the terrorist attacks of 9/11, there was a very clear work by the U.S. government to cover up and not disclose to the public what those sites were. And so there's still, Bhopal is still very much a live issue in that there are tankers running through American cities full of chlorine gas. There are highly toxic chemicals being produced in U.S. factories that if they exploded or if they were the subject of a terrorist attack, we would see another Bhopal-like disaster in the United States.
And what is known about the population that was affected in terms of their class and religious background and the like?
Well, Union Carbide decided to build their factory near railroad facilities to be able to transport their products, and there were slums that rose up very quickly during the construction part of the project, and it was very close to the city, and those continued to grow during the construction to the point where there were significant impoverished areas around the factory before it opened and continued to grow after that. And so the people who were immediately affected and worst affected were those living right along the plant, right along the railroad lines, which are government-owned, and so they're very inexpensive land for poor people to try to live on. And that's part of the reason why this issue has been so neglected by the Indian government, which till this date has not been very helpful in providing health care to the survivors, despite the fact that they have tens of thousands of very, very sick people on their hands that have, until this year, not provided adequate clean water to the citizens of Bhopal who are drinking Dow Carbide's chemicals every day. And they're finally starting to do that. But the general mentality of the Indian government, and I believe also Union Carbide and now its current owner, Dow Chemical, is that these people are poor, they're Indian, and their lives are just not worth the same as somebody else. And that's the way that this whole situation has been treated till this day, in Madhya Pradesh state, where Bhopal is located, and in India and in the U.S.
Another factor is that the population that is surrounding the factory and also which is still faced with the contamination of leaking toxics in the groundwater is mostly a poor Muslim population. And the government of Madhya Pradesh is a conservative Hindu government, and so they haven't had much of an appetite to protect their Muslim citizens.
That would be the BJP, the Bharatiya Janata Party.
Right. There's a Hindu nationalist party that runs the Madhya Pradesh government, and they have traditionally treated Muslims as second-class citizens.
So Muslims constituted the variety, the majority of those affected and are still being affected?
Well, there were more than 500,000 people that were affected by this disaster. When there was some small settlement on Union Carbide, over 500,000 people got the equivalent of about $1,000 each for 25 years of suffering, $1,000 each. And that's quite broadly distributed between Muslims and Hindus. The people that are still close around the factory where there is extensive groundwater contamination, those are mostly Muslims.
Now, explain about the water issue and what its impact is today. I mean, are you saying that Union Carbide and subsequently Dow never cleaned up the chemicals on the site and that they are now leaching in the aquifer?
Right. There's actually two disasters in Bhopal. There's the gas disaster that's very well known, relatively speaking. And then there's this water contamination issue, which has been present since before the disaster. Since 1982, Union Carbide knew that there was liquid toxic waste getting into the water table, poisoning animals. They actually compensated some people for being poisoned. And they did their own tests after the disaster in 1987 that showed that some of the water and soil in the area mixed with water had a 100% mortality rate for fish in the water. So if you can imagine people actually drinking this water day in and day out, and it's spreading in the groundwater for the last 25 years. It's about 25,000 people drinking toxic water from this huge area outside of the factory as well as within the factory that's just a dead wasteland of buried toxic waste and liquid toxic waste that was pumped into these enormous solar evaporation ponds for years. And Dow Chemical, which is the current owner of Union Carbide, they bought Union Carbide in 2001, would like this entire story to be buried, and they don't want to acknowledge that Bhopal is an ongoing poisoning incident for which that they are completely liable because they are full owners of Union Carbide. They'd like us to think that this is just a date in history and that the suffering has ended, when in fact a whole second generation has been affected both by gas-affected parents and poison water.
When you walk around the factory site in Bhopal today, you still see the abandoned factory there, and you still see the lab still there, and you see all the rotting carcass of this pesticide factory, and all these plants have overgrown it and it's become a bit of a industrial jungle, but you have this feeling of some vast tragedy having happened here. It has the feeling of when you walk around the concentration camps in Poland, you know that something really terrible has happened in this place. And the tragedy in Bhopal is that the company has never really cleaned up the mess. It's still there. They've never faced criminal trial, even though there's an outstanding warrant for the CEO of Union Carbide. There's even been a request to extradite him from the Indian government. And so they've never faced justice. They've never accepted full responsibility. The people in Bhopal who have continued to fight for their right to be toxic free, for their right to health care, for their right to justice,